John and I have been talking about for quite a while, and he's asked me probably for about the past over 2 months. We've been talking about needing to have a chance to talk about worship and true worship and what worship is. Don is, and I and Mickey are really concerned that this church is a worshiping church, and we want to be a church that worships. And a church that people love to come to and worship. And so we've been mulling this over for quite a while about talking about worship. And Don's asked me, can't you come and just kind of, I don't know if educate's the right word, but you know, just educate a little bit about worship and what worship is and how to worship and try to equip ourselves and help ourselves worship a little bit. And so here I am this morning trying to figure out what worship is. Let you figure it out with me as we go through some subjects here. Did you hear about, by the way, did you hear about that guy, the burglar that was caught? You need to be careful on your houses because this burglar had broken into this house the other night, and apparently he had scoped the house out, and so he went into the back door, sliding glass door, and he went into this bedroom, the sliding glass door, and it was pitch black, but he knew no one was home. And so he went through this back door into this bedroom, and he knew that on the counter, on the dresser top, was a drawer that the lady kept some pearls in and some jewels. And so he went through the back door, and he started working his way around the bed over to these jewels, when all of a sudden he heard at this high-pitched sound, he heard this somebody say, "Oh my goodness." And he like froze, and suddenly there was some commotion around. And he turned his flashlight as this commotion just came from nowhere. And he turned, and there were two Rottweilers standing right there, just ready to pounce on him. You know, it's like they ran into the bedroom, and he raised up, and it was a parakeet. And apparently, when this parakeet said, "Oh my goodness," it called these Rottweilers. And so these Rottweilers were like just ready to pounce on the guy, and he was like kind of trapped between the door and the jewels and death and the jewels, you know, and he's like, "What do I do?" And meanwhile, this parakeet kept saying, "Oh my goodness." And these Rottweilers were like, you know, just ready to get. And so he was like, "Well, if I'm going to go, I might as well take something with me." So he slowly opened the drawer and reached his hand in and grabbed the pearls and he put them in his satchel. And every time he moved real slow, no sudden movements, every time he moved real slow, the parakeet said, "Oh my goodness." And the Rottweilers were, you know, like waiting, you know, for somebody to, and the Rottweilers sitting there. And so the guy, he puts him in his satchel, and he starts to back out, and the parakeet says, "Oh my goodness." And the Rottweilers, and he just about gets to the door, and the parakeet's saying, "Oh my goodness." And he's like, "You stupid parakeet." He's just out the door. He says, "Can't you say anything besides, 'Oh my goodness'?" And the parakeet goes, "Sick 'em." You know, that's how it is with worship sometimes, too. Just about the time we think we got it all figured out and we know what we're doing, somebody else has something a little different in mind. And just about the time we think we're in control and we have everything just like it's supposed to be, God says, "Sick 'em," you know. There's something just a little bit more that we're not quite sure of what's going on. It's bigger. You know, we sing the words, but God listens to our heart, you know. When we think we've got it all figured out, we don't have a clue. Because God just knows a little bit more than we do, David. Isn't that interesting how that is? I wish he could teach me how to swing the club a little bit better. But God just has it figured out, you know? And the rest of us here are just trying desperately to figure it out. Well, I've led worship for over 25 years. I know I don't look that old, and I'm not. But I've led worship for over 25 years, and I usually find myself, from the very beginning, I found myself in a church, and my job was to turn the church from a sing three hymns church to a worship church. You know, and remember back in those days when you went to church and you sang three hymns, and then you had the sermon? And think about the terminology, singing three hymns as opposed to a worship service. There's a reason why we have the words on the wall instead of in a book. And, you know, back in the day before technology, we started with, "Oh, yeah, let's sing choruses and stuff, and let's put them in a book." And we found it was the same thing as singing hymns, only we were singing choruses. instead of a nice, high professional quality with the notes and everything hymn book, we had these sloppy Xeroxed, not even Xerox, what that, those old machines, you know? You know, it's just like embarrassing. And we were all reading like this. But suddenly, if you notice, when the words are up here, here's your demeanor from this to this. And suddenly when we put the words up on the wall, my parents still go to the same church, or go to the same church I grew up in, and their pastor says, "You won't catch this church singing songs off the wall." You know, it's like, okay. But suddenly when you put them up here like this, it just raises your whole demeanor. And suddenly you're here worship. And so I found myself going from one church to the next, and it's like God always seemed to call me from the next church to the next church of helping churches come into the 21st century, so to speak, in praise and worship. And they get their nose out of the hymnal and reading to opening themselves up to God and worshiping God. And so Don says, why don't you come this morning and talk just a little bit about worshiping God and what worship is and how to worship and how do we go about worship. What I found was, though, as I came to Tulsa, I got involved in a mega church, and I was part of the worship team. I was in charge of leading the children's worship, praise and worship. And what I found was, after about a year, there's like every Sunday was a production. It was like you knew all the cues. Everything was timed down to the minute. You knew how to do everything, and it was just a production. And I began to be a little bit weary of it. You know, just one production Sunday after the next production Sunday. And it was like, it became almost not true worship, but just a production. And so I found myself not really, I've never been into, I guess the best way to term it is mechanical worship. I've never been into the mechanics of it. You know, I'm not into mechanical Christianity. You know, where you just structure everything, you organize everything, and you know how to do. And if you do A plus B equals C, you know. Well, it just doesn't work in real life. I tell the kids at school, I says, that's the problem with math. It's not real. Who's good at math? It's not real, you know, because math, you get the exact same answer every time. Is life that way? No. And math, there's only one formula. Is life that way? No. There's different ways to go about it. And so I think worship's kind of that way too. We just kind of say, God, here's my heart. And I don't know what you want out of me this morning. I don't know where we're going. I don't know what it's all about, but I want to be a true worshiper. I want to worship you in spirit and in truth. Do those words ring a bell to you? You know, the gal at the well, she says, oh, but you got to worship on that mountain over there. I know how you worship. You know where you're supposed to go. Then God says, there's coming a day. And I think that day's here now. There's coming a day when we won't say we have to worship that way, or we don't have to worship there, or it doesn't have to look like that. But you're going to worship God in spirit and in truth, right out of your heart, where your heart is, and things you want. I'm going to sound a whole lot like Pastor Don right now. Are you ready? Listen to this. Is anybody hot? I'm about to cook. Where's Carol? Oh, she's not hot. Okay. So I want to talk to you just a little bit about worship. And when I began to think about worshiping and what worship was and how it worshiped, I came naturally to a guy by the name of Abraham. Let's think about Abraham. Let me just back up before this verse. Let me give you a little. And everything I'm doing this morning is out of the message, by the way. These scripture verses you see up here are out of the message. If you're a King James version, that's totally cool. King James, he was a pretty nice guy. He wasn't a Christian, but he did have a Bible made, and it's a good Bible. And so we have all kinds of different translations, the NIV, the NLT, the Message, the what? The ABS, American Standard Bible, the, who can give me some more? The RSV, RS? Come on, Jonathan. The New American Standard, the Revised Version, God's Word for the Day. The Geneva Bible, yeah. I mean, there's all kinds of translations. And all of them's good. It's good to read all of them. Then you get a good full meaning. There's also one called the Greek. You know, there's the Hebrew. You can go back to the original. You can study all of those things, put them all together. But this morning, I'm just for the sake of what I'm doing another message. But I'm going to talk about Abraham, who was a long time ago. Now, think about Abraham. When Abraham was pretty young, how old are you, Joseph? When Abraham was about Joseph's age, maybe a year or two older, God said, "Hey, Abraham, I want you to go over there." And Abraham said, "Where?" And God says, "I'll let you know when you get there." How would you like to start out your life that way? So Abraham took his wife, Sarah, who was actually his half-sister. Now, if you did the math, if Abraham was just not even 20 years old, Sarah would have been about 10. Little bitty girl. Do the math, look through it, study it, and figure it out. And he took Lot, and they went. Sarah, Abraham, Lot, and all of their crops and everything. And they went until God told them to get where. And so they went around Mesopotamia, around through the Fertile Crescent. They come down to Israel, and they come on the top of the mountain, and the spine of the mountain, they get down to the south end of it, and God and Abraham builds an altar. God says, "This is the place. This is where you're at." And so Abraham starts right there. Well, next thing you know, a famine happens. He goes to Egypt to try to survive. He tells Sarah. He told Sarah when they left, if you read real closely, "Always tell them that you're my sister. Don't tell anybody you're my wife. Tell them you're my sister." So they go to Egypt. Sarah says, "I'm sister." Well, that created all kinds of problems. Eventually, they kicked them out of Egypt. They came back up there, and then Lot and Abraham start fighting because there's not enough room for their sheep. And so Abraham says, "Okay, Lot, you take what you want to take." And Lot looks around, and he finds the most fertile ground, the best ground there is, and Lot says, "I'll take that." And so Abraham says, "Okay, you take the best ground. I'll take this rocky, dry, caliche soil up here." So Abraham stayed up there. He, about that time, God says, "Look," as he's on top of the mountain, "look as far as you can see. Look out there. Can you see all the way across the Mesopotamian to the Euphrates? Yeah. Look south. Can you see all the way to the Red Sea? Yeah. Look east. Can you see all the way to the Mediterranean? Yeah. Look north. Can you see all the way to Mount Hermon? Yeah." God says, "Abraham, I'm going to give you all of this land, everything you can see. I, Yahweh, the God of God, the I Am, the everything. This land is for you and your descendants." Do you know how much of that land Abraham actually owned when he died? The plot he was buried in. Nothing more. He and Sarah, 6x4, two little holes in the ground. That's all he owned. Abraham spent his whole life following God, going who knows where, trusting in God. Go to Sodom and Gomorrah, warn them what's going to happen. He goes to Sodom and Gomorrah, comes back, he finds Melchizedek. He bows down to Melchizedek, and he worships God, and he gives Melchizedek 10%, just like you did this morning, hopefully. If you didn't, it's not too late. You can do it before church is over. Give you 10% and say, "God, here, I give this to you." Abraham trusted God and he followed God. And God says, "I'm going to give you all this land." And he's like, "Getting nothing. It's going to be for you and for your descendants. Look as far as you can see. It's yours." Abraham's looking. He's waiting for a descendant. He can't have a descendant. Everything's going wrong. Finally, Sarah says, "Here, take my servant and have a baby with her." Not something so uncommon in those days. So Abraham takes his wife's servant and he gets her pregnant and they have a baby. All right, got a kid. Now here we go. I thought I was going to have to leave everything to my servants that work for me. But now I'm going to leave it to my heir. Well, sure enough, you know, I think God teaches it. God speaks in many ways. And I'm a historian. I think one way God speaks is through history. And I think we learn something right here through history. Sarah gives her maidservant to Abraham. Abram has sex with her. They have a baby. And then Sarah gets mad. History tells us a little something there. And Sarah says, "I don't want that lady and I don't want that boy around here. Get rid of him." And so Abraham, he's had a kid finally. And now his wife's mad. And out of honor to his wife, he sends them away. And they go out in the wilderness. Abraham still has nothing. Well, these guys show up and they say, "Abraham, now you're 100 years old. Sarah's how old, Sarah? 90. So 80 years has gone by. If Abraham was a young man, think of how young Sarah was in the beginning. Now Abraham's 100 years old and these guys come by and say, "I'll tell you what, by this time next year, you're going to have a baby." Sarah laughs. That's a crazy. 80 years we've been trying to have a baby. You're not going to have a baby with me. That's not going to happen. I obviously can't have a baby. Guess what happens? A year later, Sarah had a baby. So they named him Laughter. Isaac. So here's this rough life. Finally, after 100 years, Abraham finally has a child. He has an heir. He doesn't have all that land yet, God promised him, but now he at least has an heir to leave it to. And it's been a rough life. Everything's been bad. And after all this is where we're at right now. After all that, God tested Abraham. Now, if you think about it, it seems like his whole life's been a test, doesn't it? But it's not. It's just life. And you might have think you went through this week tested. But it's just life. God, to quote an old country western song, never promised you a rose garden. You know what? It's just life. We're just going to go through life here and see what happens. And so Abraham has gone through life. And after all this, now God's going to test him. And God says to Abraham, and Abraham says, yes, I'm listening. Isn't that interesting that Abraham would say, I'm listening? You know what? This is the first thing in worship. The very first aspect of worship is listening. One who can listen is one who can worship. And sometimes we don't have the ability to worship. And sometimes it becomes harder the more educated we become in our religious endeavors, in Christianity. Sometimes the harder it becomes to worship because we learn all the formulas. We know how it's supposed to be done. And we have this structured way of doing it. And so we tell each other, here's how it's supposed to be done. And pretty soon we're arguing. The charismatics are arguing with the liturgicals. The liturgicals are arguing with the Catholics. The Catholics, I mean, this is how you worship, and you guys are doing it wrong. In reality, when you worship, you start with just listening. God, what do you have for me? Here I am, Abraham says in the King James Version. Here I am, God. What do you want? I'm right here. Just listening to God. Listen to what he has to say. True worship begins with listening. Okay, God, here I am. What do you have for me today? I've lived all week, but here we are on Sunday morning. Right now, here we stand. I've lived all week. I've lived for 50 years. I've lived and things have been hard. Things might not have turned out like I thought they would turn out. But here I am. Listening to you, God. What do you want from me? What can I do for you? Even though things might not have gone so well, here I am today, still here, listening. And God says, take your son, your dear son Isaac. You know, the one that you love. The one you've been waiting for 100 years. The one that without him being born, you'd feel like your whole life was a failure and that I was a failure and that I didn't keep my promise to you. Yeah, that son. Take him to the land of Moriah and sacrifice him. Sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains that I will point to you. That brings us to the second point of worship. The first point is worship begins with listening. The second point is true worship comes from the willingness to sacrifice. True worship comes from the willingness to sacrifice. You know, in reality, the answer to the question is, it's not about me. Think about our society. Think about how we think it's about us. I've mentioned before Tom Brokaw's book, you know, The Greatest Generation, talks about my dad's generation, World War II veterans. They were born in the Great Depression and they sacrificed, or at the end of World War I, Great Depression, they sacrificed. World War II, they sacrificed. Came home, baby boomers, had babies, they sacrificed. They spent their whole life sacrificing. My generation, it's about me, man. The I generation, it's all about me. I don't have to sacrifice anything. I've had it handed to me. Great society, great country, great everything. Well, worship begins with listening, and it continues on to the willingness to sacrifice. What is it in your life that you need to sacrifice? Think about it. I mean, that's not even in our vocabulary. We don't even think about the need to sacrifice something. That was done away in the Old Testament. But you know, this is the problem with addicts. People who are addicted to something, they've got something and they hold on to it until it kills them. They're not willing to sacrifice. And a lot of times, it might be somebody in here that just has something. And maybe, you know, and probably addicts, I don't know, Phil, you could probably tell us better. Addicts are the last people to realize they're addicted to something. Everybody around them can see it. Phil's worked with AA and is really a leader in the whole county on this kind of stuff. Phil, why don't you talk to us just a little bit? I asked Phil to give us 2 or 3 minutes here on what does an addict, what happens to an addict?
An addict. Well, I looked it up a minute ago, addiction in the dictionary. It says to devote or give up oneself habitually. And my definition is anything that makes your life unmanageable. But, you know, most common things, drugs and alcohol. People don't think about people's places with things. You know, your work from being there, your spouse, cigarettes, lust, sex, anything that makes your life unmanageable. And what it does, any addiction that you get blocks off any chance you have of getting to God and putting God in your life. Because 99% of most addicts do not have God in their life. I guess there is a few out there that might be addicted to God, which that's probably a good thing. But somehow they fly by the way, screwing it up. Remember, he was born with that desire God put that desire in our hearts. Well, most addicts, they fill it with drugs or alcohol or sex or work or a number of things.
You could be addicted to anything.
You could be addicted to anything. And until you get that, until you have the energy in your life to fill that hole and to help you get that addiction, get shed of that addiction. And for myself, that was the only way, was to ask God to help me fill that hole and not do drugs and alcohol and cigarettes and everything else out.
If an addiction runs its course, what will it eventually end in? No escape?
You'll either clean up, you'll get covered up, or you'll be locked up. And that's your going again. You know, it's the addict thinks that it doesn't affect anybody but himself. But it affects everybody around you. In your immediate life circles, your family, the people where you work, you're calling in sick at work all the time, you got to hang around, I can't make it, I'm sick. You know, your wife calls you, where you at? I'm off having a drink with my buddies. And, you know, next thing you know, it's 2 o'clock in the morning, they turn the lights on at the bar, and you're sitting there, what happened to this time? You know, well, we're going to do that this time. Well, that happened again. Addiction just totally controls your life. And then you'll end up paying the price, and that'd be death.
And so, an addiction is something that consumes us. Consumes us a lot. I was reading a book when I was in college called The Octopus. It's about the Silicon Valley. Thanks, Phil. Let's give Phil a hand. It was about the Silicon Valley and the competition between the farmers and the railroad tycoons. And the farmers trying to control their own wheat and the railroad trying to control the wheat. And this battle that was taking place the whole time. Who's going to make the most money off of it, how they can control it. Of course, the farmers, they needed the railroads because if they didn't have the railroads to ship it, well, then they couldn't sell their wheat. And so the railroad kind of just having this power struggle over the price of the wheat with the farmers until eventually the guy that owned the railroad company won the battle. And he's standing on the edge of his ship as he railroaded the wheat from the farms to the dock, and he's putting it on the ship to send it to China, and he's standing there just admiring his accomplishment towards the end of his life and just happy as could be as he stands there on the edge of that ship, and all of a sudden he slips and he falls into the bin, and these big elevators are dropping the wheat in. And he thought, well, I can handle this. I'll just get on top of the wheat, and as it fills up, I'll step back out of it. And as he began to struggle, he learned that he couldn't get on top of it. And the wheat kept coming in, piling on top of him. And he kept struggling, trying to get up on top of the wheat. As he was trying to get up there, it was like drowning in wheat until eventually he was buried alive. And it consumed him. Whatever you worship will consume you. Whether it's work, whether it's wheat, whether it's religious events, whether it's drugs, whether it's prescription drugs, whether it's alcohol, whatever it is you worship, whether it's God, whatever you worship, he'll consume you. And so God asks us to sacrifice not that thing, but to sacrifice our addiction to it. Can you think? Not that Abraham was addicted to Isaac, but after 100 years, Abraham drastically needed this heir to pass on what he believed was his promise. And God said, sacrifice your thoughts to me here. Give them to me. Sacrifice to me. So what did Abraham do? Abraham got up early in the morning. Say early in the morning.
Early.
Say that again. Early in the morning.
Early in the morning.
Who likes to sleep till noon?
Me.
Say early in the morning, Phil. Abraham got up early in the morning and saddled his donkey. This brings us to the third point. The first point was listening. The second point is a willing to sacrifice. The third point is a true worshiper does not hesitate. Don't hesitate. God asks you to sacrifice something, do it now. This is the point. Which is easier, Phil? To give up your addiction when you're 18 or to give it up when you're 38?
18.
Stop when you're young. Don't hesitate. Right now, I mean, there is no better time to give up, to sacrifice an addiction than right now. There's no better time to give up an addiction than right now. Tomorrow's not better. Right now. Don't hesitate. Right now, God said, listen, are you hearing me? Be willing to sacrifice. Don't hesitate. Right now, get up early in the morning, do it. Now, don't be an idiot when it comes to worship. If God tells you to do something, do it right now. But, you know, there's a lot of strange people when it comes to worship. All of a sudden, they think they have to lose control and disrupt the whole service. And I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about real life. Right now. Say, here I am, God. Here I am to worship. Right now. He took his two young servants and his son Isaac. He had split the wood for the burnt offering. And he set out for the place that God... Look, Abraham's still going someplace God's directing him to. And on the third day, it took him 3 days to get there. But he set out on the first morning. On the third day, he looked up and he saw a place in the distance. And Abram told his two young servants, stay here with the donkey. The boy and I are going over there to worship. And then we'll come back. Say, come back. Then we'll come back to you. This is the fourth thing in worship. True worship is believing. I'm listening. I'm willing to sacrifice. I'm not going to hesitate. And Father, I believe. It's going to be okay. You may have had a rough life. You may have had a miserable week. You may think that you're giving up the very thing that God's promised you. But the point of the matter is, God's promised you. It's okay. It's all right. God will take care of it. No matter what it is that I'm hurting over, it's okay. God will take care of it. True worship is believing. Believing is simply trusting in God. Now, we live in an area that I never dreamed in the world I would live in. We live in an area that I've always referred to as hyper faith. People who have faith in faith. You know, it's like, just conjure up enough belief. If I can believe bad enough, I can get it. That's not it at all. Faith is kind of, you know, it's like a constipated worship. Oh, I just know I can. And that's what they look like as they go around trying to, you know, it doesn't work. It doesn't happen. It's like, I'm trying, but I just can't do it. That's true. You can't do it. That's the point. Worship is not about you. Faith is not about you. It's just saying, God, I trust you.
Hallelujah.
And watch what happens. All of a sudden, God starts moving. And it's kind of, faith is kind of an oxymoron, because faith is kind of a giving up. It's kind of a letting go. It's kind of saying, God, here, let me just trust in you. It's like the kid learning to ride a bike. You know, when you learn to ride a bike, you're like, you're fighting with it the whole time. And your dad's having to hold you, you know. As soon as your dad holds you, you're fighting with it and you fall over. And suddenly when you let go and you just relax, suddenly you find yourself going down the road and you're free. Faith is like learning to ride a bike. It's like just relaxing. Not trying to force your dad to hold you up. Not saying, if you let go of me, Dad, I'll fall over. That's what we try to do with faith. We tell God, if you let go of me, I'll fall over. I promise, I'll fall over. You hold me, you hold me. I have enough faith in you, Dad. You hold me, you hold me. I have faith in you, Dad. And Dad is saying, I have faith in you. Relax. Or like a friend of mine who says, I was teaching my daughter how to swim, and I would hold my daughter and teach her to float, and I would hold her there. She was like 18 months or two years maybe. And I would hold her on the top of the water, and I'd say, just relax, relax. And I'd move my hands, and she would start fighting. And as soon as she started fighting, she'd start sinking. And he'd put his hands back under and say, relax. Trust me.